On behalf of the Professional Baseball Strength and Conditioning Coaches Society, I'd like to welcome you to the PBSCCS podcast. I'm your host, Chris Messina.
All right, everybody, I'm here with Ryan Fair of the Cleveland Indians organization. Ryan, thanks for coming on, man. Appreciate your time. Tell the listeners about yourself, if you would, please.
Well, first off, Chris, I appreciate you having me, man. Really, really good opportunity. Been listening to the podcast for a while, and obviously to contribute to the organization in any way is a pretty awesome opportunity for me. So thanks for having me. I'm born and raised in Central Florida. So I'm from the East Coast, but right now I'm currently in Phoenix, Arizona, working for the Cleveland Indians organization. Basically a baseball lifer in a sense. At 4 years old, I started playing the game and played it year round until I was 18. And at that point, kind of jumped into coaching high school ball and just coaching baseball. Started training some of our ball players at the high school and trained the team. And over the course of 4 years in undergrad, got to coach at the collegiate level a little bit, interned there, got an internship in pro ball, and really have never left coaching or baseball ever since. So been in professional baseball for a couple of years, really, really enjoyed it. And it's been a great journey so far.
So you've bounced between high schoolers and pro ball. You were at your high school you went to, right, for a little while?
Correct. Yeah. DeLand High School in DeLand, Florida.
Okay. That side note, that's really cool. Every time I go watch my little brother play at his games, I'm like, man, it'd be cool to get back to the high school. So kudos to you for doing that. But, have you experienced any differences between working with high schoolers and pro ball players, or is it more similar than people would think?
Well, it's funny, especially working at the level that I do, which, you know, I've had a lot of experience in pro ball, specifically with rookie ball players, young players, so Latin players that are 16, as young as 16 years old, and then newly drafted players coming in. It's actually more similar than people would think. I kind of just look at it from a training age standpoint, because baseball just isn't really one of those sports where strength training has traditionally been a staple for kids as they grow up. It's starting to become that way. It's definitely more prevalent, as you know, but a lot of times these kids come in, especially when they're so young, and they really haven't been training consistently with a really a committed program for very long. You know, even if they have been, it's maybe been for a year or so. And at the end of the day, I mean, they're so highly skilled at the game and such a skill dominant sport that a lot of times those general movement patterns and that general strength just really isn't there yet. And that's, I mean, it's the same thing that I saw at the high school level. I see a lot of those same similarities in professional baseball. The differences that I see is more so in, I mean, it's more about the approach that I would take with an athlete necessarily. So with a high school athlete, it's kind of different. Personally, I look at them, and since they're kids, they're 14 to 18 years old. The majority of them are not actually legally adults, and we're in the education system. I never want to give up on a kid ever, and I never really want to allocate my resources and my time differently between kids. I'm going to give every single kid everything I got. I'm not going to give up on them until they're no longer in my class or they're no longer at training. And regardless, at DeLand High School, I had classes where I had non-athletes as well. So, whether you're an athlete or not, I'm going to give you everything I have and try to make the strongest, most profound impact on their lives that I possibly can. In the professional setting, it's more about, just for me personally, my coaching style is just more about being a resource for those athletes, the best resource I can possibly be. And at the end of the day, they're professionals. The majority of them are legally adults, and not that I will ever give up on them, because they're part of our organization. I care about them as individuals, but at certain times you might have to shift resources and allocate your resources and your time a little bit differently between athletes, depending on their needs and really what they're willing to put into the game and into their training. So that would be the biggest difference. But ultimately, I have a lot of experience at the high school level working with baseball players as well. So the 14 to 18 year old, their movement capabilities and competencies are actually quite similar to the 16 to 22 year old professional baseball player in a lot of senses.
Okay. And so that transitions us into our next thing here, our main point. is a topic that I just recently saw that you had presented on. I saw the slides, you posted them on social media. We're talking about movement links. And so I think probably just start with what they are and then maybe progress into how you use them and maybe why you think they're important for others to use.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's funny because the idea of movement links, I wrote a blog post and I really was just trying to organize my thoughts on how I went about coaching high school athletes or novice trainees and teaching them my fundamental movements, because I started to notice it wasn't something I came up with and then implemented. It was something that I noticed that I had been doing progressively from year to year because I kept having to start athletes over. So when I was just coaching as a college student, I was coaching high school baseball and training high school baseball players. Every year you got a lot of new players, and sometimes you'd have a big gap in the summer where you wouldn't see them. So you'd have to reteach a lot of things. So every year I felt like I would restart how I would go about teaching these fundamental movements. Same thing when I took over full time at DeLand High School, teaching 300 plus or 400 plus athletes that way. And then in professional baseball. And I just started to notice that I did the same things, and I paired a lot of the same movements, reiterated a lot of the same coaching cues, and put athletes in like associated movements in a way that at the time didn't really know this is what I was doing, but was helping them, I think, learn those movements better or more efficiently. So essentially, movement links is just a name I gave it. You know, I feel free, anybody can come up with whatever name they want. It's just a way to kind of, for me, to categorize it in my head, but it's just using associations between movements and between exercises to help kind of like interweave movements so that an athlete learns them better. Just basically, it allows for repetition without that explicit repetition. So for an example of that would be when teaching. So a foundation movement for me would be a hip hinge at the high school level. And really, I mean, I think generally most people's programs, you know, some sort of hip hinge is very important. And so not only will I teach the actual RDL hip hinge, and I'll do it pretty much unloaded, and I'll try to put them in the positions to learn the hip hinge on day one or day two. But then I'm going to start, once I feel like, okay, we have a feel of what a hip hinge versus, you know, just reaching from the lower back or squatting with the knees, once we can dissociate that and know what a hip hinge specifically is, I can start to utilize that between movements. So for example, anytime I want my athletes to do a T-spine rotation, rather than putting them on the floor first, I'm going to actually put them in that hip hinge position and have them pop an arm down on a bench and then go through their T-spine rotations. And I'll tell them the same cues or say, give them the same feedback that I would with an RDL. They should feel those hamstrings stretch. The hips should push back. I could tell them to shift their weight back onto their heels, whatever the cue might be. Same thing with like a single arm dumbbell row, as opposed to starting with their knee on a bench. I'm going to put them in that same position for the hip hinge. We're going to go feet right underneath the hips, toes straight ahead. We're going to have a nice soft bent knee. We're going to push our hips back and then just pop one hand down onto the bench. And now we'll row. And I can show them that that's going to put them in the safest position. And I'll tell them, hey, you should still get that feedback. If you feel that stretch in the hamstrings, you're probably in a good position. Taking that, you know, one other example from that would be the use of scapular protraction through movements, because that's another one. So using that single arm dumbbell row, I can tell them with their down arm to protract the scapula and push that bench away from them with their down arm. On the very first day, typically with novice trainees, I teach them the high plank, you know, so basically essentially the top of the push-up position. And in that position, there's two things that are vital to me. And one is getting that neutral lumbar spine. So pulling that belly button up might be the cue that I use. And then the same thing, just pushing the floor away. So no soft shoulders, push that floor away. And be in a nice stable position with the shoulders. And so I'll go through multiple exercises teaching them the difference between protraction and retraction and basically just associating them. So that was just one way. So like I would gladly share my slides with anybody, but I used a couple different types of associations that work for me. I'm sure there's 100 different ways and things that other coaches can think of, but one is associating movements and positions like that. Another is just associating and disassociating stances. So knowing the difference between a squat stance that I initially teach. So for me, just to make it simple, feet a little wider than hip width, toes out at 1 o'clock and 11 o'clock. And then knowing what their power position is. So that would be that RDL stance. So feet right underneath the hips, toes straight ahead. And then just breaking them in and out of that stance over and over again. They don't know that they're getting repetition on what those stances are. They're just implicitly learning them as they go along, or maybe feeling tension between movements would be another one as well. So, like I said, I'd be glad to share so I don't ramble on about that, but it's just a way of teaching fundamental movements that works for me. And I only hope that sharing can maybe help other coaches.
Yeah. Well, prime example. So I brought my brother into the gym. We started a program 2 weeks ago. Now he's 14. And I taught him the hip hinge, and then we're doing dumbbell rows, and he just can't get the position. And I had just read your slides, like, literally that day. And I was like, how about you do hip hinge and then put your hand on the bench? And he got it. And he's like, oh, my hamstrings are stretching too. And when I talked to him, I got to let him know, you know, thanks for sharing and making that easy and making that connection. So
that's awesome.
For sure, man. That's really good. So you said you've used them with younger guys. Have you tried with older guys too? Or is this just something you use to kind of reteach people positions and stances and so forth?
Yeah, so I've definitely obviously used it with the younger population. With my current role, I'm also on a day-to-day basis working as the rehab coordinator. So I've been able to kind of, especially for guys that have longer term injuries that are shut down for quite a while, basically break them down from the beginning and try to teach, if necessary, teach quality movement in that way. And typically with the limitations they have, we may not be able to load them up anyway. So it's like a good opportunity to either reteach movement or to teach it from the very beginning. So I'll utilize those as well. I just may not necessarily put it into a framework like I did at the high school setting, which is, okay, this is our block zero program. So this is, you know, it's laid out so that those links are all throughout the program. It's more so just looking at what an athlete might need. And I might just need to pull one of those links, quote unquote, out of the bag and throw that at an athlete to help him learn it better if he's struggling with it. So it's more like in your case, you see something's just not quite connecting. So let's pull one of those tools out and throw it in, as opposed to using it as an overarching program that I would use like at the high school level.
Perfect. And we'll include the slides in the show notes so people can check those out. And if they have questions, they can get in touch with you. So shifting a little bit, what do you believe in within strength and conditioning that others think you're crazy for believing?
Wow, that's a good question. I think my philosophy is so bland that I don't know that many people would think I'm crazy. If anything, I mean, it's sometimes it's so basic that maybe those that like ask me my philosophy might go like, that's it, you know? So maybe that's more the angle. I mean, I believe in building, you know, quality movement first above everything else. And so I know maybe it's not necessarily coaches think I'm crazy, but sometimes I think athletes probably look at me and actually one of my athletes made a joke the other day about it, because, you know, they said, you know, like, I'm going to leave here with the best squad I've ever had, you know, before, because Ryan's going to make sure of it, you know, because I tend to be very nitpicky with technique. And it's not because I think my athletes are, you know, going to be these great weightlifters or strength training athletes. It's just, if we're going to work on something, you know, I want to give them the opportunity to get really good at it. So quality movement just becomes the basis of everything. And in that sense, as the athlete evolves and they become better at moving and become more competent, I still don't ever really take the magnifying glass away. You know, I never say like, that's good enough. I probably just kind of make some fine adjustments and zoom in a little bit more with the microscope instead, and try to improve movement still. You know, I don't want to be overbearing, but, you know, movement quality at the end of the day is something I think we can all work on and constantly get better at, even if we've been training and playing for years. Just like, you know, a pitcher is going to need a pitching coach to fine tune mechanics, even if it's very, very so slightly, even when they're a 10-year vet. So that's the basis for me. And then, you know, on top of that, I just think strength is a vital quality, and I want to build relative strength first. And then go from there. So those are things that I really believe in, and that are kind of like building blocks for me, even though sometimes they're a little boring and tedious.
Boring and tedious is usually what works, though. So right on, man, right on. So what do you believe makes a strength and conditioning coach, quote unquote, successful?
I've learned that everybody's a little bit different. We all have our own ways of coaching. If anything, I've learned that because I feel like I'm very different. Sometimes I wonder how I got into strength and conditioning, because I'm not the most vocal, energetic guy all the time. Sometimes I lay back and I'm just watching, and I'm a pretty reserved guy. And I like to think that maybe comes from all those years of playing baseball, where it's a very focused, and you're dialed into the moment in baseball, and then there's very few times where you can get a little emotional and let that emotion out. I'm the same way with how I coach. So I think everybody's going to be different, but I think at the end of the day, the most important thing is that your athletes believe in what you're doing and they buy into what you're doing. So there's trust. I think to do that, you have to be yourself. I mean, you have to be transparent. You have to be real. It used to be, you know, when I was younger and I was coming up, I started coaching at 18, and I remember, like, I was coaching athletes that I played with, and it was about being an authoritative figure and always having this hard line of where I'm never going to cross. And now, as I'm getting older, I'm still relatively young in this field and as a person, but I feel like it's more about being real, and I'm going to let players that have put in the time and have been around me to know a little bit more about me personally and to really see my true colors as a coach and as a person. And ultimately, I just do that so that they trust me and there's a relationship there, so they buy in. So I think every coach can do that and do that within who they are and not have to actually change and be somebody else.
Yeah, I agree 100%, man. Being true to yourself and just letting the athletes see that this is who I am really does create that trust and that buy-in. So very good. Along those lines, do you have any advice for others in the field, maybe young strength coaches looking to get into pro ball or even high school athletics, or guys that have been around for a while and they're just looking for more knowledge?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there's a lot of things that have been taught to me that have been all the things that have, I guess, been passed down from generations of coaching that, you know, that have just ringed and always been true. And it have worked for me as well. And first of all, you know, my upbringing into coaching has been more about being in the trenches, and not that I'm not trying to, you know, I don't read books. In fact, that's one of my favorite things to do is read and learn, but ultimately learning through trial and error and not being afraid to fail. And at the time it wasn't like, I didn't go out there and say like, I'm trying to fail. That's the last thing I was thinking at 18 years old. But I mean, that's really what I was doing. I look back at my programs when I first was allowed to train a baseball team, and I'm like, man, that's rough. What was I doing? You know? And every year I think I look back and I still say the same thing. So being able to coach and learn the X's and O's through self-study, through formal education, and then applying that experientially was huge. But moreover, I learned who I was as a coach by coaching every day. And again, I was failing every single day, and really that wasn't my intention, but I just learned who I was as a coach. So by the time it was my turn to actually become a true professional and for this to thankfully be my career, I knew who I was already. I didn't need to try to figure that out. So, but going through those probably 4 years of undergrad where I was coaching, networking was huge. I was told from basically day one that who you know gets you the job and what you know helps you stay there. I think it's important to network, and not only necessarily to get a job, but to learn. You know, I remember at 18 sending out emails and sending out 50 emails to strength coaches just asking to like be in the room and watch. And I maybe only got two or three responses, but those two or three responses made all the difference in everything I learned and all the connections that I've been able to make. So that was huge for me. And I think just not, especially at the high school level, it's so, coaches need help. So even if you don't come in and you know, they don't want you to run a strength training program, and that's fine. Maybe you're not in a position to do that anyway. That's okay. But if you offer the opportunity to come out and volunteer and maybe run a warm up or feed guys on the tee and do some field work, and then eventually over time you earn the responsibility of running a warm up, then you earn the responsibility of conditioning and then lifting, you know, that's your way in the door. Because honestly, high school coaches are typically underpaid and underappreciated, and they just need help. So those are probably my biggest tips as far as some advice that I think could help.
Ton of good stuff there, man. Ton of good stuff. So you mentioned reading. I saw on your blog that you have your list of books. I'm a big believer in just keeping a list of how many books you've read and what you've read. So where are you going for continuing ed? Any good books that you might recommend, or podcasts to listen to, seminars that you've been attending? What do you got?
Yeah, so as far as the book list, it's been awesome because by sharing that, now people come to me and they tell me what they're reading, which is awesome because there's no way I'll possibly ever read every book. And I have I probably, if you were to look around my apartment right now, I literally have books everywhere, like on the coffee table, under the coffee table, on the bookshelves, under the bookshelves. Like, it's crazy. And I'm always trying to keep up with what I'm reading, but I just get more ideas from people. They send me on Twitter like, oh, hey, I just read this. You'll like this. So me sharing my book list was great. One of the biggest books that I thought was really beneficial to me was Athletic Movement Skills by Clive Brewer. That was a huge one for me because honestly, it was in the area that I already thought I had a lot of experience in, which was teaching movement skills to athletes, to young athletes, I should say, and novice trainees. But then I read that book and realized, wow, I really don't know all that much. So that was an awesome resource. And I actually plan on going back to reread. So that's a good one. And then as far as like podcasts, I was always a big fan of Mike Robertson's, physical preparation podcast. Obviously the work that you're doing is outstanding, especially for baseball specific and then professional baseball for those that want to get in the field or those in the field. Just almost like it's like networking without necessarily having to be in the room together. So that's huge for me. I was always a big fan of the NSCA conferences. Obviously, being in pro ball, it's hard to get out there now. But the NSCA coaches conference is one that I always love to go to. It's typically in January, I believe. So hard to get out there right now. But that event, just for the networking alone, to be around other coaches was so beneficial for me, especially as a college student coming up, just to immerse myself in the strength and conditioning world, even though I knew nobody and didn't really know a whole lot.
Cool. Thanks for the plug, first of all. I think I took the Bolt Supremacy from your list. I'm pretty sure that one was on your list. Mm-hmm. When I saw it, I was like, okay, I got to get it. Read it, really good. So thanks for that. And the same thing happens to me. Like I'll read one book and then I'll see somebody's list and I'll have to order five more. And before I finish those, I order five more. So my wife is just like, can you just read the books you have and then move on to the next? And I'm like, no, somebody said I'd like this one, so I got to skip those other ones. So I know exactly what you're talking about there. Cool. So I know you're packing. I know you're going to the DR soon and going home. But if you got time, can we do a lightning round? What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I'm a little concerned with what these questions are because I'm not as prepared for them. But yeah, let's do it for sure.
All right. So the first one, who is your biggest influence in the strength and conditioning field?
Ooh, in the strength and conditioning field, there's two that pop into my head. One is Brad Loki was my director at Stetson University back when I did my first collegiate internship and got to coach alongside with him very intimately. I learned a lot just about what it means to work in the field of strength and conditioning for him and putting in the time and earning your stripes. And then Chris Dunaway, who was my coordinator with the LA Dodgers, was a huge influence when I was still coming up and going through school. So he is still somebody who I consider a strong mentor in this field.
All right. Second one, one piece of equipment to train with, what would it be?
One piece of equipment. Oh man. if you have weights, a barbell, or a kettlebell. Yeah. Just so many things that you can do with those two implements and you can add load. And I'm a big fan of intensity with quality movement. So that's huge for me.
Okay, I'm on board with that. I like the barbell. You can add the plates too. That's fine. They come okay, perfect. As a set. The third one, biggest accomplishment professionally and or personally?
Professionally, just this past year has just been really, really awesome for me. And I'm so humbled. The opportunity to work for this organization, the Cleveland Indians, and to have the role that I do and have people believe in me here is really awesome. And then I've been able to start speaking at a couple events. So professionally, like that's just, it's been really rewarding and really humbling. Personally, just being able to get to this point, and not that I didn't have help, I absolutely had help, but I just remember those days of, as far as coaching in high school, where I really doubted myself and really never thought this would amount to anything, but still getting up to train 20 high school kids at 5:30 in the morning for no money, like just wondering if I'd ever make it. So it's still professional, I guess, but that was just more of overcoming like all that doubt that we all have as we come up through this.
Awesome, man. It's really inspiring. And then the last one, any career other than strength and conditioning, what would you choose?
I'd be a writer. So for those that follow me on social media or that know me personally, they know that I'm actually doing my master's degree right now in science writing. which actually isn't even like research articles type writing, because that's what everyone initially thinks being a strength coach, but it's actually journalism for science and medical writing. So I enjoy writing. I love to do it. If I'm going to go get a degree, another degree, I wanted something that could maybe broaden the way that I look at this field and expands out there, everything that I'm trying to do. And obviously my blog really is to help high school and coaches and high school athletes. But at the same time, like, I just love to write. So I guess if I could do anything else, I'd be writing. But I, like I said, I love what I do. So I'm very fortunate.
You think that coursework is helping with your blog? Just kind of maybe shaping how you write and everything?
Yeah, it's changing the way that I look at what I'm writing. Because I used to just put out blog posts and I would try to do like one a week or two a week, and I'd just get them out there. My punctuation wasn't great. Like, it's very informal. And now I find myself like, I only put out an article once every 2 or 3 weeks now, but I want to make sure it's a good one. Like, it actually matters. It can help people, and that it's written relatively well, but also stays within like my voice. Again, almost like coaching. Like, I don't want to try to be anyone else. I don't want to try to sound like too much of a writer or anything like that. I still want to be a coach and come off that way. So it just has me thinking about what I'm writing and how I'm writing it.
I got you. All right, man. Well, it's been a good time. We've had a lot of good stuff. A lot of good, you know, tips and advice from you. If the listeners want to get in touch with you or learn more from you, where can we go? I know you said your social media, your blog. Where can we go to get more from you?
Yeah. So I have a website. My blog is my first and last name, Ryan Fair, RyanFaer blog, blog.com. Twitter's probably going to be the way that I respond the best. I'm typically pretty slow in every other avenue as far as social media goes, but, my Twitter handle is at my first name, Ryan, Ryanunderscore Fair, FAER. Definitely feel free to reach out, and I can give you some more personal ways to get in touch with me then too, through those means.
Sounds good, man. Well, thanks for coming on and taking some time out of your day. I know you're packing for the DR, so I'll let you go, and safe travels on your trip.
Thanks, Chris. I really appreciate it. You're doing great work, man.
Thanks, man. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, everybody. That concludes our episode with Ryan. I hope you enjoyed it. He shared a lot of good information about movement quality and how to teach your athletes to move well. Three things that I learned from Ryan. Number one, be a resource for your athletes. Number two, don't be afraid to fail. Learning through trial and error is a great way to learn. And number three, network and reach out to as many people as you can. With that being said, I hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll talk to you again on the next one.